This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Republican Phil Scott spent a decade in the Vermont Senate before being elected lieutenant governor in 2010. He's now running for a third term in that position. It could be seen as a lonely position. He's the highest-ranking Republican in the state, the only Republican to hold statewide office at all right now. But he has negotiated friendships and relationships with many Democrats in the statehouse and has even garnered the support of Senate President Pro Tem John Campbell and others. Phil Scott's progressive Democratic opponent Dean Corin says Scott is long on likability but short on ideas. And Corin says voters are looking for more substance from the lieutenant governor's office.
You have an incumbent who has spent 4 years doing things that make everybody in the state feel like he's a nice guy, not hold him to account on any particular issues, and really not know where he stands on any issues because he's done a really good job of ducking that.
Corin hopes he'll be able to unseat the popular incumbent in 2 weeks. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to see if we can get a handle on Phil Scott's positions on health care, the economy, energy issues, and other topics important to voters. I want to point out as well, later in the week, we will be speaking with Dean Corin. But in the meantime, Phil Scott, welcome to Vermont Edition. Nice to have you back.
Nice to be here. Thank you very much.
And listeners, if you have a question on any of the topics that are coming up in the state right now that you'd like Phil Scott to address, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So, Phil Scott, is Dean Corin right? Short on ideas, short on real succinct positions on the issues facing the state?
Well, I think you have to understand what the lieutenant governor position really is all about. And I think I've fulfilled my responsibilities and gone beyond. I've done a lot of different things in Vermont. I've stayed in touch with Vermonters through a number of different ways. Our office does an incredible amount of constituent work. And we field calls from all over. When folks hit a brick wall with the bureaucracy, they tend to call us to seek relief. They feel as though they can talk with me and that I'll do whatever I can to help. So from a constituent service standpoint, we've been very successful. I also do that Vermont Everyday Jobs Tour where I've worked in over 30 positions throughout Vermont, keeping my finger on the pulse, so to speak, and working alongside employees and employers to understand their struggles, both, again, individually and collectively. So I bring that back to the State House, and I have a great relationship with a number of senators and legislators and the administration and secretaries and commissioners, and I'm able to bring that back, and I think help. I'm a problem solver. I'm pragmatic. And, you know, I think we have enough activists in the State House. I think we need more problem solvers and people that actually do the work.
Let's talk about one of the things, obviously, that's in the news this week, and that's the IBM Global Foundries deal. Your immediate reaction to that?
Well, I thought it was good news from the standpoint of providing certainty both to the employees as well as to the surrounding area, the families. And employees have heard this for quite some time, not knowing exactly what's going to happen, whether they're going to have a job in another 6 months or not. And I think that this gives them that certainty that something is going to be there for them. And again, the ripple effect of IBM in the 4,000 to 10,000 jobs over the last few decades has been so instrumental to not just that region, but for Vermont as a whole. So I thought it was positive news. But at this point in time, I do feel as though it's the slate is clean. I think that we have to acknowledge that they're very important to us and that we need to foster that and work alongside the new owners and hopefully grow that business to what it was once was.
So do you believe the state should be providing incentives to Global Foundries to not just stay but expand in the Essex plant?
I think it's too early to say. I think we need to communicate with Global Foundries, establish a relationship with them, understand what their needs are before we automatically react. And we don't know at this point what it is that they need. But again, being able to sit down with them on a on a regular basis, I think, is going to be essential in understanding what makes them tick and what their needs are, whether it's workforce development, whether it's infrastructure, whatever their needs are. We should then take that in and figure out whether we can help. We need to be partners.
The Department of Labor released statistics yesterday about Vermont's unemployment rate, and the unemployment rate has risen to 4.4%. It's the fourth drop in a row, fourth monthly rise in a row. What's your reaction to that, and what's your perspective on how to reverse that trend?
Well, again, it's always a concern when you see the unemployment rate fluctuate. But I've been maintaining all along that it's far less important what that rate is, and it's far more important to look at the amount of people employed. That's the real number, the net number, and that's where I think we have some challenges ahead. I think our workforce is shrinking. We're an aging society here in Vermont. Our population is stagnant, and I think we need to pay attention to the working class, those in the category from 25 to 45, and we've lost a tremendous amount of those people over the last decade, according to the census. So that's the area. Demographics are one of the biggest problems that we're facing in this state, and how that relates to revenues and how we grow in the future is something we must pay attention to.
Well, we as a state have been paying attention to that and worrying about it for more than two centuries now. And so it's obviously not something that can be solved by a very quick, you know, two-sentence prescription here. But what do you think would be helpful in reversing that trend? Youth flight's been a problem for us since we were sheep farmers in the 1800s.
And it's a problem throughout the Northeast. While we acknowledge that, the crisis that, again, I think we're facing as a state, and this goes along with what I'm feeling as I work alongside all these employees, is their struggle with affordability. They're working two or three jobs trying to make ends meet and not able to pay their rent, or getting behind on their rent, or paying their property taxes, or just putting fuel in their oil tank just for heat. And that's a real problem for them. And when you're faced with, and that has all kinds of ramifications, family issues and so forth, and pressures on an already overburdened family situation. So we need to create more prosperity here. I think we need to listen to businesses more. And be more receptive to both large and small. I mean, this isn't about just large businesses. This is about small business as well. They're the backbone of our economic vitality.
But so then what? What do we do? Because a lot of businesses, or you hear often that there are issues with bureaucracy in Vermont, or that we need to reform Act 250 permitting, and that might make it easier for businesses. Is there anything that you point to that you say, here's one step that might help?
And let's just go back, I mean, just a little bit about how we prioritize. When you look at the number of bills that were introduced over the last biennium, there was 1,211 bills introduced. When you take a look at, dissect that, there was about 20 of them that would have had a positive effect on the economy. Out of the 20, a couple passed. That doesn't tell me that we're putting it on the front burner. That doesn't tell me that we're really paying attention. Other situations that you look at, there's one going on right now, and this may not have a big effect on the large population of Vermont. But when you look at the farm dealers right now, they're involved in a huge controversy with the tax department about the amount of tax that the tax department feels it should have collected, these dealers should have collected. There's one in the Randolph area that just went out of business. And I think they sent him a bill for $250,000 of uncollected tax. He didn't collect it. It's not like it's sitting in the back room somewhere. And it's almost like an I gotcha type of approach. And I believe that we need to be more proactive. We need to educate retailers and these businesses. It's not as though they're not trying to collect the tax. It's a gray area, and they don't understand it. And this goes
What tax are we talking about? Like a sales tax?
A sales tax, a use tax with farm implementation devices, machinery, greenhouses, compost. And it really is a gray area, and some have not been collecting that. So what do you do at this point? My feeling is if you want to really help businesses, you work with them. And if they didn't do it knowingly, maybe we start off now. But why not take a more proactive approach? We did this. I'm in the construction business. We used to fear labor and industry. Labor and industry would come onto your job site, and you were going to get a penalty. You were going to get fined. That if they showed up, no questions asked, that's what's going to happen. And then there was a change in philosophy, and it came, I think it was during the Dean administration, which was really very helpful. And what they said was, we're going to come onto your site. If you want us to come, we'll take a look and see where your shortcomings are. We'll tell you what they are, and then we'll give you an opportunity to fix it. If you don't fix it within, and we may come back in 2 or 3 weeks, and if we find that you did not take a different approach, then we're going to fine you. But buyer beware, so to speak. And that approach has been so helpful to the industry. It's changed the dynamics because the goal is to keep workers safe. So if you work hand in hand and you try and take that approach, then everybody wins. Same thing here. If we would spend just a fraction of the time that we spend auditing and educating, wouldn't we get better results? Wouldn't we be collecting taxes? Wouldn't we be saying to these retailers, you know, these are the areas. Here's a sheet that tells you exactly what we want you to do. There's no gray area here. This is what we want you to do. They'll collect it.
So it sounds like what you're saying is not necessarily that the state policies are out of whack, but that we just need to have them be better understood by everybody in the state, but not that we need to change them necessarily.
No, just attitudes and the way we approach things. And again, I mean, that's just one small example of the frustration I think that business feels sometimes. They're overwhelmed and they don't feel anybody's on their side. When you take up provisions as we've done, take paid family sick leave. A number of businesses like ourselves, we already do that, and we take care of our employees. It's one we pride ourselves on that. If somebody's sick, we take care of them because they're important to us, and you know, business gets the feeling that we're just a bunch of bad guys, and we're just out to take advantage of our employees, which is just isn't the case for the majority of Vermont businesses. So again, it's more of a working hand in hand, a different approach to how we do business, and understanding that we need businesses to survive so that we can have the revenue to do some of the good things that we do.
We're talking with Phil Scott, the lieutenant governor today. He's running for re-election, and we're getting his take on some of the issues facing the state. And if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Mark's calling in from Verscher. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Hi, Phil. This is Mark McKee. I'm on the select board in Verscher, and I've been told I've got 20 seconds, so I'll make two quick questions. One is, I'd like to know your thoughts on the overlap of the permitting agencies in the state. We have a little bit of a kerfuffle going on. We thought we were going one direction, and then we got told no, and the result is that we're kind of treading water looking for a direction. And the other one is, I'd like to get more specific in person. I wonder if there's a number or a time that I could reach you and talk about it more.
Sure. Let me answer the second question first. You can give us a call anytime at 828-2226. And again, we've helped. We feel that probably 1,000 to 2,000 constituent calls over the last 3 years or so. So that's what we try and do. We don't have the answers, but we can open up doors and hopefully get you into to talk about the issue. The other part is part of what our challenge is as we move forward is to try and do something to bridge those gaps, provide a more seamless type of approach with the permitting. We've heard about permit reform forever. I was on a when I was first in the Senate, I was on a conference committee between the House and the Senate, and I served with Peter Welch and Ginny Lyons, and it was a conference committee that went on for about a year and a half. And we looked at structural changes to the permitting process. And what we found is that there is overlap between local, state, federal, and all kinds of different permitting. And it's very confusing and daunting for many to go through. And it's not that we want to degrade that that environmental process. It's more that we want to make sure that it works efficiently and that people get the answers that they want sooner rather than later. And it's that uncertainty that I talked about before with IBM, that businesses and individuals, we dislike uncertainty. We want to know what's going on. We want it to be clear, and we want to know what's ahead of us so that we can make decisions about how we move forward. But that may not be what you're talking about, but I'd love to hear more about what the issue is in Berkshire.
We got a question from Claudia who says, you were endorsed by Vermont Right to Life. Do you accept their endorsement?
Well, actually, I was not endorsed by Vermont Right to Life, I wasn't even somebody told me that I was, but apparently it's the same as last time. I've never filled out a questionnaire for Right to Life, and they put me on a favorable list and of candidates that should get consideration. But
Just your position on abortion?
I believe in a woman's right to choose. I always have, and that has been clear from day one.
We're talking with Phil Scott today. We're getting his take on issues facing the state and questions from voters. You can add yours to the mix at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're speaking today with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, and we're learning his priorities for a third term in office. He's hoping to win in 2 weeks, and he's answering voter questions about his politics and policies. If you have one for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Chuck in Springfield emailed us to say, with Obamacare now in effect in Vermont as Vermont Health Connect, insurance companies are guaranteed income from people who are compelled to buy insurance. Although they may no longer discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions, they legally can offer plans that do not cover services needed by those people, thus preserving their profit margin. The proposed single-payer system would end such practices as this, but Vermont Republicans are opposed to it. What do you offer as an improvement over both private health insurance company practices and Vermont's version of Obamacare?
Well, first of all, thanks for the question. Second of all, I'm not sure that all Republicans necessarily disagree. If you've been listening to what I've been saying, I've tried to be objective about single payer. I've been condemned for that on both sides, to be perfectly honest, the far right for not condemning it and far left for not blindly following along. But from my standpoint, I need details. You know, I think single payer, what does that mean? What's the plan going to look like? What is it going to cover? Is it full range? And as soon as we can clarify that, then we can get to the point where how much is it going to cost and who's going to pay for it and how? But we have not had any details whatsoever as to what that means or where we go from here. So until we do, I'm skeptical, admittedly, but I'm trying to keep an open mind. Just prove it to me. I think the administration has failed to meet certain deadlines. I think that we need those details in order to move forward. And we're not receiving them. So,
and at what point do you say, look, the administration, the governor himself has blown through his own deadlines in providing a funding plan for single payer health care that he has promised repeatedly? So, at what point do you say, look, if you can't give us the plan, I can't, you know, I have to withdraw my wait and see attitude and just not support it.
Well, again, I think, you know, that's become, I think that's become plan B. I think plan A is right in front of us, what we're dealing with right now. I think the Affordable Care Act is a federal mandate. To go to single payer would require some congressional action. I think that what we should be doing right now is getting the exchange to work. It's been a disastrous rollout. And I think that whatever happens, it doesn't matter whether you go to single payer or not. And that's what I'm finding throughout Vermont. So many people are getting confused between the exchange and single payer and what that means. They lump it together and they're two totally separate animals. The exchange is something, again, federally mandated, something that we have to do. And we've chosen a path of a customized type IT structure that isn't working.
Do you think we should switch to the federal website?
I do. I think that when you take a look at what we spent so far, $70 or $80 million that we've spent for a system that is not working or functioning at this point, and then you just look across the border to New Hampshire, who has a federal exchange, just like 27 other states have done, and they've done it for $8 million. And it works. It's fully functional. So maybe we should take a look at that. But instead, you know, I heard last week that we've entered in another contract with Optum, the new IT provider, for $15 million. When again, it seems like, you know, the foundation wasn't designed properly. It's not working. We're going to have this Rube Goldberg setup when we're all done. I think it's time to stop digging and admit that we failed. And there's no shame in admitting failure. The shameful part would be not to do what's right for Vermont.
And you think the right thing is just go to the federal website at this point.
It's proven. It's working for half the states in America.
We have a lot of questions for you on energy issues from listeners. Casey emailed and says, Vermont has made a commitment against fracking in our state and has the goal of obtaining 90% of our total energy from renewables by 2050. Yet the Shumlin administration is supporting a huge infrastructure development to deliver fracked gas to an out-of-state private corporation, International Paper, in Fort Ticonderoga, New York. Running a fracked gas pipeline across Lake Champlain could put the entire Lake Champlain watershed at risk, in addition to overriding residents' wishes in Addison and Chittenden counties who don't want the pipeline going through their properties. Do you support or oppose this pipeline?
I actually support the pipeline, and I think that it provides an incredible amount of relief for those struggling Vermonters in Rutland County in particular. This is maybe a bridge to where we need to go. I still believe I'm all for renewables, cost-effective renewables, something that I think we can obtain in the future. But in the meantime, Vermonters are suffering. And as I talked about before, the crisis of affordability that we're facing is faced by individuals and employers. So if we can provide some relief in this way, then I think we should move forward, but not ignoring that we need to learn how to take care of ourselves, become more self-sufficient, increase ways that we can take care of ourselves and our energy needs through renewables.
So is it all right with you if Vermont Gas Systems takes some of these properties by eminent domain?
I'd like to think that there's a ways to work around that. I think eminent domain shouldn't be used frivolously. I believe that it should be absolutely the last resort. And if we have to go a different route, then I think we should make those exceptions because property rights mean a lot, and it's their property, and I hate to see the use of that.
But ultimately, may be the way it looks like it's going.
Yeah, it may end up going that route, and if so, then I think they should be compensated fairly.
Maeve in South Burlington asks, do you support divesting the Vermont State Pension Plan from fossil fuel corporations, saving Vermont pension beneficiaries from the increasing carbon bubble risk?
Well, I would say that maybe throughout the next couple of decades, yes, but immediately, no. because there's a lot of money that's being brought in at this point in time. I think the treasurer has reacted that way, that we benefit from our investments at this point, and to sell off immediately would put the state at risk. And again, I keep talking about the crisis of affordability, where we faced a budget. We had a gap 2 weeks into this new fiscal year. We faced a shortfall of $31 million, and we're forecast that could be doubled and or tripled as we get into the next quarter. So I'm looking for ways for us to save some money and to do things more efficiently, and I don't think we can afford to do that right now.
JT puts a fine point on your philosophy here and asks, is addressing climate change a priority for you? How do you think Vermont can be a leader in the fight against climate change?
Well, again, I think I always look for ways for people to win, no matter what the situation is. If we can all focus on the goal of taking care of ourselves, becoming more self-sufficient, and becoming free of foreign investment, free of foreign oil, and reducing our carbon emissions. And if we all can agree that that's the goal together, because I think all extremes can agree to some concept that would get us to the same place, then I'm in favor of it. I think that's where we have to go. So I think we're on that path. I think there's a ways that we could do that sooner rather than later.
But given that you kind of set your own agenda as lieutenant governor, and should you be reelected again, you have some flexibility in figuring out what your priorities are and what issues you want to work on. Is climate change a priority?
That isn't my priority. My first priority is providing a more prosperous Vermont, putting the economy on the front burner, prioritizing that crisis of affordability, and bringing keeping more of our youth here, bringing more youth in, and creating that, helping out the middle class. I think that's my priority.
As we go to that, let's hear from Bill, who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
I'm glad to speak to his last point, because I think a more prosperous Vermont is in the procedure of a new idea, and he's looking for something. Phil is looking for something to revive the Republican Party, and what we need is wealth distribution in a way that favors all people, and so that it's wealth redistribution. And policies that will support that are for people who are moving to the state to retire. And in Addison County in particular, we have a high concentration of people moving here who have great wealth, and they also have excess wealth. And we need to move that wealth to people who have no credit, who have talent, who have employability, and can start their own companies, and who have jobs and need to be able to buy their own places rather than becoming part of the high district rent that where they lose all their income. They need.
So, Bill, do you have a plan for how you'd like to see that wealth distribution and what you'd like to see Phil Scott fight for?
A new idea for prosperity of Vermont. And I think wealth redistribution is one of those ideas. And the Republican Party should latch on to that with many policies.
Well, let's ask Phil Scott, is that something that you can get on board with?
Well, I'm not sure I exactly understand what that means, but I believe in the American dream. I believe that we need to inspire people to do more for themselves. I've worked tremendously hard over my life and tried to do what I can in this environment. So I don't know about if what he's talking about is somewhat of a socialism type approach. I don't think I'm in favor of that.
We're talking with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott and learning why he thinks he deserves a third term in office today. If you have a question for him, post it at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. Bill was talking about reviving the Republican Party in Vermont, and we got a note from Dennis who says, as the de facto leader of the state GOP, are you concerned that you have virtually no running mates? Why has the party failed to contest certain statewide offices and legislative seats?
Well, again, we have to take a pragmatic approach and do whatever we can to rebuild the trust, I think, in our brand. It's been, I think, from a national standpoint, has been hurt. And I think it's up to us to act appropriately and again, talk about some of the issues that are important to me, fiscal responsibility, smaller government efficiencies, and so forth. I think that's what I stand for, and I think that's what are benefits of the Republican Party. So we need to prove that. And you can't, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take some time, and you have to, you can't do everything.
Well, and Tyler in Cambridge wrote in to say he's a graduate student at UVM and has noticed that the Democratic Party and other liberal-leaning groups are taking very active steps in recruiting college students. Tyler says, do you think the Vermont GOP has done enough to engage younger voters? And what could you do to bring more people into the party?
Well, I know we're trying in terms of my own campaign. We have a lot of new, younger volunteers that have come on board, and that's obviously a great point. And again, it's to benefit our youth in the future and our policies and taking this pragmatic approach and how do we deal with the situations where we've been dealt. So I welcome them in, and I do take that point, and we're trying to practice that.
Let me just squeeze one more topic in here before we let you go, Phil Scott, and that's about school issues. And you mentioned property taxes being high, the burden on property taxes. Do you think either school consolidation or school board consolidation is the right way to go to try to reduce costs? I mean, where do we go here with school funding and property taxes?
Well, at the end of the session, there was some movement on a bill to consolidate schools, and I felt at the time it was too little, too late, and it was more about politics and getting something passed so that legislators could go on the campaign trail and say, we've done something. See what we've done. I think, you know, we keep talking about what we're going to do, and I'm happy that Speaker Smith has decided that we're going to take this approach sooner rather than later and address this. But I don't want to just reconfigure the formula. I think and that may come as well. But we have to address the spending side. I mean, that's when I've been in business for 30 years, and when you have a revenue issue and you can't repair that, then you've got to look at your operating and overhead costs.
And isn't that what consolidation's about?
Well, it could be, but I'm not sure that's the best approach. It might be one of many provisions, but I think that there's another approach, and I've talked about this a little bit with this Green Mountain Education Board idea, similar to the Green Mountain Care Board. But it's just an idea. It's just something that we should contemplate. And again, getting on the same page and agreeing what the problem is.
All right, just 30 seconds here, Phil Scott, before we let you go. But why should voters put you in power again here in the lieutenant governor's seat?
Well, again, I've spent my whole political life in the minority, but I found ways to work with the other side. I've reached across the aisle. I have a great number of people that are supporting me from both sides of the aisle, and I think that's a tribute to the respect I think that I've gained. That I don't play politics, that I'm trying to do what's best for Vermonters, and I'll continue to be that pragmatic, hardworking type person that they've grown accustomed to.
That's Phil Scott. He's Vermont's lieutenant governor, and he's running for a third term. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Phil Scott's leading challenger in the lieutenant governor's race is progressive Dean Corin. He will be our guest on Vermont Edition this Friday. And be sure to tune in next Tuesday evening for a live debate with Phil Scott, Dean Corin, and Liberty Union candidate Marina Brown. Details are at vpr.net. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Vermont Psychiatric Care Hospital in Berlin opened 4 months ago. The $28.5 million facility is the centerpiece of the state's mental health care network. It was hoped that the opening of this facility would help alleviate a shortage of beds for psychiatric patients, an ongoing problem since Tropical Storm Irene damaged the state hospital in Waterbury. But the new hospital hasn't been able to fill all of its beds, in part because of a shortage of psychiatric nurses. The new hospital has been using traveling nurses to fill some of the open slots. Christine Ryan is the executive director and lobbyist for the Vermont State Nurses Association, and she's on the line with us now. Christine, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Do you know what the situation is like right now at the hospital with nursing staffing?
Well, I have had conversations with David Mitchell, who's the director of nursing there, and from what we've spoken about, I can say that it looks like the workforce, the nursing workforce there, is represented between 40 and say 50% with traveling nurses. So what that says is that, from a nursing perspective, there is a Vermont nursing shortage within that facility.
And why is that a problem? If they're able to fill it with traveling nurses, is there a problem for either staff or patients with that arrangement?
I think there's a couple problems with that. I think, first of all, when you're looking at the critical nature of the work that's being provided by nurses, travelers are obviously filling a need, which is very important. But over the long run, you're looking to build continuity. You're looking to build teams. You're looking to create a strong foundation within a facility. And when you have folks who are coming and going over periods of time, that is disruptive. The other thing that's of concern is when you're looking at budgets. It's very difficult to build a budget when you have that type of influx. You are dealing with a much higher rate for travelers than you would be for Vermont state nurses. And I think that that poses many challenges.
Is the daily rate for a traveling nurse much different than for a staff nurse?
I don't know the exact figures, but I do know that it does tend to be higher because of, you know, the fact that they are traveling. They are on the move. They are leaving what might be, you know, their home destination to come work in another area, another state for a period of time.
So, Christine Ryan, what do you attribute the shortage at the psychiatric care hospital to?
Well, I want to say two things. The Vermont State Nurses Association is an association. It's the voice for the 18,000 nurses in Vermont, and I'm proud to be one of those nurses. And when I think about Vermont, we do have nurses here. We have lots of nurses here. But we do have a shortage of nurses with this particular specialty. And some of those reasons are one that you mentioned earlier in the program when you spoke about Hurricane Irene. We had a displacement of patients and nurses. So that was certainly part of it. We've been looking at our healthcare system delivery in Vermont as well as nationwide, and we've recognized that the way we utilize our emergency rooms needs to be improved upon. When we look at the psychiatric patients, that's a population that could be better served somewhere else, and we know that. So we've tried to respond to that by building, you know, better facilities that are more appropriate and are speaking to their needs directly. The other thing is the recession hit, and so nurses who may have decided to retire or changed careers stayed on. And what that meant is for newer graduates or for folks returning to nursing school or back to the profession, didn't find the jobs that might have been there because they were still being held on to. So I think that's part of it. I think the other part is that psychiatric nursing is a real specialty in the nursing profession. And it's a very difficult job, physically, emotionally, mentally. I think that the compensation is an issue. We talked a little bit about this already, but, you know, the Berlin facility is a state facility, and I think that's going to be a challenge if you're going to be paying state wages, you know, compensation, where nurses can get jobs in other parts of the state. We also have New York and New Hampshire, where Vermont nurses go across those borders to work. So that's a challenge. And I think that we've seen an increased need. Our state and our leaders have done a great job by saying, you know, this is an area of care. This is a patient population where we can do better and they can be better served. But with that comes the need to build infrastructures around that. You know, Governor Shumlin mentioned in his State of the Union address the opiate crisis. Again, where are the resources for that? And nurses are part of that resource equation.
So when you're talking about that, I mean, it sounds like there are a couple of different issues here. There sounds like is a shortage of psychiatric nurses, not just at the hospital, but in the state. And then there are other issues that are perhaps leading people not to want to go into that particular field.
Correct.
Do you think that there's anything that the state could be doing either to attract more nurses or to make the job more appealing that could have avoided the situation that we're in now with perhaps up to 50% of the staffing, the nurse staffing at the psychiatric care hospital filled by traveling nurses, visiting nurses?
Yes, most definitely. I think one thing that comes to mind was when the conversations were occurring, and mind you, they were very articulate, thoughtful conversations. When Irene hit and there was a need to create another infrastructure, and, you know, literally down to the number of beds, there was a lot of dialogue about what the building would look like and what it needed. And I think what would have really been an important part of that dialogue is, what do we need for nurses? What kind of nurses need to be there, and how many do we need, and what does it need to look like? Because my sense is that we built this infrastructure, but we forgot a foundational piece of it, and it's not as simple as if you build it, they will come. I think it's more challenging because of so many of these variables right now. And my hope, and I think the nurses of Vermont, and clearly this particular patient population would have benefited from having that type of a dialogue included in that. I think some of the other things would be to develop a really strong training program for nurses currently in school or nurses who are looking for a change, to create a conduit between this facility or facilities like it in Vermont and the nursing programs in Vermont. We have strong nursing programs in Vermont, and we have many, and we have lots of students. And if we gave folks specific training or incentivize them, there's a resource pool right there. Look at the compensation. It has to be fair, and it has to be equitable, and it has to mean something. This is hard, hard work. And if you want to build those teams, if you want to bring those people together, whether it be the physicians and the nurses, I think, and the support staff, mm-hmm. you need to be mindful of that.
I'm going to stop you there because mm-hmm. we're out of time, but that gives us a lot of food for thought here as we look at a shortage of nurses at the psychiatric care hospital in Berlin and why that might be. We've been speaking with Christine Ryan. She's the executive director of the Vermont State Nurses Association. Christine, thanks very much.
Thanks, Jane.
And we're going to spend a little bit of time now with your messages to the program. Producer Patty Daniels is here with me. Hi, Patty.
Jane, we have been hosting political debates for statewide races this month. So far, we've covered the governor's race, U.S. House, Secretary of State, and Attorney General.
After the Attorney General debate between incumbent Bill Sorrell and challenger Shane McCormick, we heard from Matthew, who wrote, "Interesting debate, and I'm glad I caught it. Thanks to VPR and the two candidates that could join. I was on the fence regarding who I will support during the debate, but the ending pushed me towards Sorrell over McCormick. I'm up for new blood, but I found McCormick's remarks on the sugar tax and how the government should not be involved to be short-sighted."
Challengers do face long odds in many races this year. For that reason, one listener wasn't impressed with our U.S. House debate with incumbent Democrat Peter Welch, Liberty Union challenger Matthew Andrews, and Republican Mark Donka. We heard from Ian Lord, who tweeted, "All of Peter Welch's answers in this pointless VPR debate should be, I'm Peter Welch, and I'm going to be reelected to Congress. Thanks."
During that House debate, Peter Welch asked Mark Donka about the scientific basis of man-made climate change. In his answer, Donka cited a Middlebury College professor named Richard Wolfson.
He said, "There's no firm evidence linking extreme weather to human activities, and it's not clear that the Antarctic ice sheet is actually shrinking. Antarctica is actually getting bigger right now. It has more ice now than it's ever had in history."
Well, Professor Wolfson was surprised to hear his position quoted in the debate. He sent us this response. "The science is crystal clear. Global warming is real, and it's largely caused by human activities, especially carbon dioxide emissions from burning fossil fuels. This is a scientific statement, not a political one. Ironically, the point I was making," says Professor Wolfson, "is that Mr. Donka entirely took my point out of context. There are subtle aspects of climate change that climate activists would do well to understand so that they can rebut skeptics like Mr. Donka."
Professor Wolfson went on to say the point in question is the complex behavior of Antarctica, which is gaining ice in some places and losing it in others. Yet both gain and loss are the result of global warming. Mr. Donka's out-of-context quote only stated that Antarctic ice is increasing, which he took as evidence against global warming. In fact, it's the opposite. Climate science can be subtle. Mr. Donka's simplistic argument from an out-of-context quote is neither responsible, nor valid, nor helpful.
Moving away from the political for a moment, when we looked at issues of youth homelessness in Vermont and the challenges that youth face in finding secure housing and stable jobs, Paul in Warren shared this story.
When I worked at Youth Build, we had a student who was about to lose his housing. The staff was frantically trying to find new accommodations for him, but I was surprised and shocked when he said to me, "It's okay. I've been homeless before. It's no big deal." No big deal. I would have been beside myself with anxiety if that were about to happen to me, yet he was resilient enough to take it in stride, which is a quality I found in many such young people.
Well, we always appreciate your comments. Please send us your ideas for topics you want to learn more about, people you want to hear from, and places we should be exploring on Vermont Edition.
Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net or connect with us on social media. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Vermont Edition. Patty, thanks.
You're welcome, Jane.
And that'll do it for today's show. Tomorrow, energy efficiency. We've probably all bought compact fluorescent light bulbs and Energy Star appliances, but is that the best possible thing we could be doing to use less power? And what should we be doing as a state? Diminishing our ravenous appetite is the goal of Efficiency Vermont. We'll talk with the utility tomorrow, and you can send your questions or suggestions to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. Our production staff includes Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.